Welcome to the Wisdom Circle. To subscribe or follow us on your favorite podcast platforms, please visit us at www.thewisdomcircle.com.
Welcome to the Wisdom Circle. I am Tony Ponturo, along with my good and longtime friend, Ray Warren. You can find us anywhere you watch podcasts. And I think some of you hopefully are back for many times. We're almost coming up to a year. Who knew that would happen? But we enjoy doing it. We're learning, I think, as much as hopefully you are. Our guests have been great, and it's just a pleasure for us to bring it to you a couple times a month. Ray, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great, Tony. Thank you. A year goes by quickly. So we are advancing the cause of the Wisdom Circle. It's been a lot of fun. We've got a lot of great guests. No shortage, which I think you said it once, is that's kind of how you know you're falling out of favor, is if somebody says, yeah, and I'm pretty busy that day. How about 2 weeks later? Yeah, I'm going to be busy that day too. We're enjoying having all this great, I think, really spectrum of guests from 28 years old, maybe to, plus 50, we'll say. I think, that's been, for me, the learning part is it's really a broad spectrum of points of view and generations, which, that's what we were talking about, trying to stay fresh and stay current and stay and learn until there's no more time to learn.
I know. No, well, we both consult, and there's nothing worse than hiring a consultant who only talks between 1985 and 2005. So it's just relevant. We've gotten a lot of great perspective. I'm not going to steal the thunder. We'll do a better introduction, but we have a great guest today, Kathy Cosso, who I had the pleasure of working with for 20 of her 26 years at Anheuser-Busch. And I'll do a little better, but she's going to give us a great perspective on a lot of things, particularly women in business, because when she started in 1989, particularly at a beer company, as she looked around the room, she may have been the only woman in a meeting, but she'll talk more about that. So talking about change and things sort of evolving over time, you started in the agency business, but you spent a lot of time sort of at ABC and, as you call it, legacy media. And we're seeing, the evolution. I mean, we both have been around long enough to see the beginnings of ESPN and CNN and satellite TV to the internet explosion, now streaming. And the whole thing is sort of on another sort of massive evolution. So what's your observation going on these days?
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, it is really, this is the time in one's life where it's really good to have been around. I was saying yesterday, so Netflix earnings came out, and their earnings came out and were great, but then they had Moffitt Nathanson came out and said that they think that the bump they've had in some new subscriptions based on not allowing password sharing is about washed out. They've cleaned out all the chat password sharing, and their stock dropped 100 points, 8%. Netflix, right? Pure streaming, pure play. They're not Amazon. They don't have trucks and deliveries to 50 million homes a day. They're not Apple selling phones and watches. And that was stunning to me, because on the same day, I'm reading a story about Comcast, my wonderful company that I love, but like the truth is, facts are stubborn things. Comcast is struggling, losing cable subscribers, spinning off NBC because the cable business is in decline. Peacock is not quite working. So you've got a legacy media company that's having a really hard time, and a pure play streamer that I don't know how old they are, 10 years old, who's struggling. So I don't know, I guess I just didn't see that coming,
Well, and so, I was accused of this at Anheuser-Busch by our president at the time, because I made this comment I'm about to make, and he said, well, that's sort of a socialist comment, versus being a capitalist comment. But it would drive me crazy. So let's use an example. Anheuser-Busch would have anywhere from seven to 10 increased profit return every year. And Wall Street got to a point that says, well, we really want you to have 12 to 15. And I would say, well, why? You know, what, you know, or we're going to give you the stock price increase. And companies start to make decisions then that are not really in the vision of how they wanted to build step by step by step. So I'll make somewhat a controversial comment. People may disagree and you may disagree, but it's, we seem to be driven by the financial community of more dollars. But does that always serve the companies well?
Yeah.
Or the sports league well, or the sports team, you know?
No, I don't think, you know, so first of all, there was always this talk, you know, when Comcast bought NBC from GE that, you know, they were selling furniture on the 14th floor to make the 90-day quarterly earnings report look better. And I think it was true at some point. It was just all about, you know, Neutron Jack being a hero and hitting the numbers. So, you know, I think it's more of a cultural issue. And I guess we could talk about capitalism and socialism, but, you know, I must always remember the Japan specifically had a 20-year view on things. They didn't do 90-day plans or five-year, they did 20-year plans.
Yeah.
And America seems to just keep, like, burning out every plan until it's just, you know, burnt out. Expansion of franchises in the MLS that might be a little early. Like, they haven't gotten their game together yet to be in that, you know, just always trying for more. And I don't know that there's a lot of attention paid to the longer term because the press is there every day asking for more. I mean, you just talked about Anheuser-Busch. I think our culture is not built around long-term plans.
No, and we, you know, Disney, so the parent of ABC just announced 2 days ago, a 6% cut. You know, the technology companies are cutting. God knows the government's cutting. And so my always argument is, well, now we've put 10% of the population out of work. So how's that good for us as citizens, right? But no one really thinks of that. It's like, yeah, but your bottom line's going to be 3% better. Don't worry about those 10,000 people you just put on the street. So, you know, and we as a society, a corporate society, tend to wait till something breaks to fix it. Now, you know, we always say, let's not talk all about sports, but you now have ESPN, which is, again, trying to cut costs because they're basically Disney. And so they go to Major League Baseball. Hey, we have a little clause in our option, so we're going to cut Major League Baseball. And then maybe you'll be back to us and we'll renegotiate. You know, so it's like, well, you were real bullish 5 years ago, and now you're not so bullish because how you managed your company.
Yeah, so it's funny because there's a question I wanted to ask you, actually. But the comment I'll make first was about my mentor, who will remain nameless, at ABC, said to me once, yeah, they asked me for a five-year, he would run the upfront primetime television, ABC television network, smaller universe of options where all the content delivery systems there are today. And they would say, so what's your five-year plan? And he would say, +7, +7, +7, +7, +7. Like, that was his plan. He didn't know if that was right or wrong, but it was, I'm going to try and get 7% more every year. Okay, that's your five-year plan. And it was with one of those skeptical looks of like, yeah, whatever. And so I was going to ask you, as one of the guys who helped build ESPN,
yeah,
what it feels like. Because I didn't really have this thought about you specifically and Chuck and giving them that down payment, yeah, and that they're opting out of baseball. Like, weren't they doing, like, you know, firecracker rallies and ponies? And, I mean, like, you know, slot cars. What was ESPN's content? And now they're walking away from baseball. I just found it like, wow, that's, it's, you know, it's interesting.
Well, here's the interesting, a little insight, and I'll try to do it in 2 minutes, not 15, but...
Please.
ESPN, I mean, Anheuser-Busch and ESPN had two different five-year contracts that got started. $1 million a year, total beer exclusivity, with what I'll call run-of-schedule kind of sports.
Yeah,
and the contract said, if we ever get anything like NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, then you're going to have to re-up your money, right?
Sure.
And buy those as an incremental. The third year, I'm trying to think, probably was Major League Baseball. they got like a, you know, 100 games, you know, and it was like, okay, this is going to add up too much. So we said, okay, we won't buy that exclusively. But we'll participate. But again, showing you the greed of organizations. So they then sold Miller for $500,000. And let's say we were spending, you know, two and a half. Okay, here's Major League Baseball, but we'll give you the trademark ESPN logo for that. So now at retail, where we had been the owner of ESPN, if you will, as a sponsor,
right,
our wholesaler said, well, wait a minute. Miller looks just the same as us at retail because they're using the ESPN mark. So I went into Steve Bornstein at the time and said, okay, for a third, and this is what sales people sometimes don't understand, for a third of what we're spending, you just gave them the trademark, the same as us. And he said, yeah, I'm sorry, that's what we're doing. I said, well, guess what? We'll no longer be exclusive on your network anywhere. And that changed the dynamic of ESPN because they weren't willing to work. Now, did ESPN get hurt, you know, over time? Now, as they brought in Miller and Coors, maybe not. But we weren't going to be stupid, right, and keep paying a premium of out-of-pocket costs and lose exclusivity of the trademark. So a little background of,
yeah,
of, again, the greed factor, but not, right, protecting who brought you to the dance, right?
Yep. Oh, yeah. I know that really irritates the life out of you, so...
Oh, no, you gave me all the answers.
Take a breath.
You know, lastly, before we bring in our great guest is, you know, I think what we're seeing.
Exactly right. It talks to both sides of the changes and the short-term thinking.
Yeah. So we'll move on because we have such a great guest. So Kathy doesn't know this. Kathy Cosso worked at Anheuser-Busch for 26 years. I would say to people, even if they didn't ask, if I ever started a division of a company, a department of a company, or had my own company, Kathy Cosso would be the first person I would ask to come work in that company.
I agree.
She is that kind of person, just a real dynamo. And she started with us as a coordinator out of college. She was a women's soccer All-American before women's soccer was, you know,
cool,
you know. I used to always laugh because, you know, we were, again, one of the sponsors of USA Soccer and the Women's World Cup. And during the Olympics during the 95 Women's World Cup and then the 96 Olympics in Atlanta, I would say, where's Kathy? And he goes, well, she's hanging out with the U.S. Women's Soccer. She's at their party. It's like, oh, great. Because she understood it. They loved her. Everyone loved her. She was just a smart person, and so she had all those tools. She then, when InBev bought in Anheuser-Busch, after a few years, and, you know, we were empowered, InBev liked, you know, 10 people in a room to make a decision, and Kathy was there, so I should let her articulate it. She then actually moved in to be a vice president of consumer education awareness, which was very important, started by the old Anheuser-Busch, as I call it, about don't drink and drive, know when to say when, really strong programs that became not only important to do the right society thing, but also as we would get called in by attorney generals and the U.S. government and the FTC, et cetera, to say, you know, you need to understand we're spending $50 million a year to tell people only drink when appropriate, and even when you can drink, do it in moderation. So it was a really important program, which Kathy held on to. So I think I propped her up way too much already. So with that, let's bring on Kathy Cosso. So here we are, Kathy Cosso. Have I embarrassed you enough in your introduction? How are you today?
Well, you propped me up so much, I'm surprised my head fits in the frame. you know, those were really kind words. I appreciate that. And yeah, I wish you would have started that company because I would have joined you.
I sometimes wonder, even though I went off and produced those Broadway plays, it's like, well, why didn't I start a sports marketing company? I was still only 56 years old. I would have grabbed some of you out of there and we would have had some fun.
I was waiting for it. And, you know, I always told everybody on the flip side, I tell you what, if Pinturo starts a company, he better hire me.
I should have had this conversation 15 years ago. That's the amazing thing is I you know, I almost obnoxiously still talk about Anheuser-Busch, and I realized it was 15 years ago after I left. But that heritage of what we did, I'll say proudly.
I continue to remind them, Tony.
That's right.
You gotta let go a little.
Yeah, but Ray, you were part of it. I mean, you were.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
I go back to 19. Yeah.
You know, it was, I tell you, there'll never be, in my mind, there will never be a time or a company that had that kind of just pure dominance in a specific field. I don't know that you ever see that again.
Agree. I just worry about his blood pressure, frankly. It's more of a health issue.
Right,
it's not about.
I was at a restaurant the other day, and I was away a few days with my wife in Phoenix, and the waitress came running over, and she goes, "Yeah, what do you want? What do you want?" I said, "No, no, I'm just Italian. I'm talking with my wife and my." So we've always been sensitive to not go down this way with a woman guest, but you've actually encouraged it, which I think is really cool. And going back to as you say, the time and the culture that was built. But when you first came into Anheuser-Busch in 1989, it's probably 21 years old or 22 years old, having been an All-American soccer player. But when you looked around the room, in many cases, you may have been the only woman around the table, or, you know, and so you sort of start and take us down that road. It's like, you know, women, what are we now? You know, 35 years ago, at a beer company dominated by males. What was that like?
Yeah, it was definitely a different time. I sat in many meetings as the only woman, went on many trips as the only woman. And, you know, it's interesting, and I think it should be talked about because, you know, first of all, I got a great opportunity. I got a great opportunity to work at Anheuser-Busch in sports. And I wasn't gonna let anything spoil that for me. So, you know, it was kind of, it was baptism by fire, so to speak. And, you know, I didn't have a lot of female role models that I could lean on, right? So I had to change, I had to do things differently. And I watched a lot with the successful people, particularly the males in the company, what they were doing, right? And I think it's important to talk about because I think even today, I think some of the advice that I'll give, it's still very pertinent. And it works, you know, it's just a young person in the workforce, right? Trying to build your credibility, right? I mean, it's all about building credibility and trust. And so for me, one of the biggest things I learned was that knowledge is power. And knowledge is empowering, particularly for women. And so, and it was on me to know what I didn't know. You know, it wasn't, you know, Bruce Hudson's job or Mark Lamping's job or Steve Uline's job or Tony Pantero's job to fully educate me. It was my job to learn what I needed to learn and to understand the facts and understand all the things that I needed to know to be smart in the room so that I could grow my credibility, right? So I spent a lot of time understanding what was below the surface. You know, and Tony and Ray, you know, the rights holders and the intricacies of those deals were all different,
yeah.
Right? I mean, baseball was different from football, and football was different from hockey, and, you know, and then you had the lifestyle sports, and everything was different. And so that one piece, you know, just knowing your stuff was so important, and it really helped me. It helped me be credible in the room. When I was sitting in the room, guys.
Right. I got questions. First, I want to ask them in the right order. I guess the first one would be, did you feel like you had to be smarter? Like, was there like a gap because I'm female in a room of males and they kind of, no offense, my friend, get away with some things because of the guy thing. So I've got to be smart. Like, did you feel like it was about knowing what you had to know, or you had to know more than what you had to know to kind of compete, I suppose, in a room?
So, Ray, that's a great question. It depended on who I was in the room with, right?
Oh, wow.
So yeah. Some guys, like Tony, were very confident with themselves, and they didn't have to push me that way, right? Mm-hmm. And he respected me out of the gate. Right. And that's the second point I'm going to make, and I'll come back to that. But it depended on who was in the room with you. Some days I had to be smarter, and some days I had to be just as smart.
So, wow.
Yeah. And so,
I told you she was smart.
So you had to know, who you were dealing with.
You played the room, more or less, but you had to have all the knowledge you might need, not knowing if this was the day you had to be smarter.
Right.
Right.
So you had to learn it all so that if you had to be smart, you could be. And if you didn't, then, you know, you could offer something extra maybe. And that was great. But, you know, you learn that in sports, right?
Yes.
So if I'm defending somebody and in soccer and I know they go right and, you know, they shoot with their left foot, then I know that that's what I have to be smart about. But if the next player gets subbed and the new player comes in and it's different, then I have to adjust.
Right.
Wow. So a lot of what I learned in the business world came from playing sports. You
Isn't
know,
that true?
A lot for of it.
Who do? Yeah. And that was an early time to have been advanced in sports competition as a woman, because we also know that didn't start a long, long time ago, the way, you know, Major League Baseball has been around since 1908 or whatever. So men grew up playing Little League at 5, and, you know, and so anyway, I'm sure that was an early advantage for you having been a participant. So second question I have, sorry, Tony, I'm not going to hijack the whole episode, but I just,
no, that's good.
Two questions, one left after this. How did you get into Anheuser-Busch? What was the path to hire a woman at Anheuser-Busch and kind of put you in this fishbowl of men?
So I'll be honest. So, not that I wouldn't be honest, but
no,
you know, so Judy Roberts was the executive assistant to August Bush III, and I got to know Judy through coaching her daughter in soccer, and I got to know her, and I befriended her. And, you know, and at that point in time, I was in college playing soccer. And when I graduated, she said to me, you know, you ought to interview at Anheuser-Busch. And I said, well, I know that they have a sports marketing group down there. I would love an opportunity in something like that. So Judy got me an interview. Just so happens the interview was with Mark Lamping. And as small St. Louis can be, the Lampings grew up with Picassos. Right. So I knew Mark was a friend of my brother's. So
let me just interject, because not everyone will know necessarily who Mark Lamping is. So Mark worked in sports marketing at Anheuser-Busch, went on to be president and CEO of the St. Louis Cardinals, went on to then help build the MetLife Stadium in New York. And for the last, 10 years, maybe, has been the CEO of the Jacksonville Jaguars. Anyway, that's Mark Lamping.
Yeah. Okay. So I got my interview. Right. And I got hired as an intern for a 3-month internship. And I worked my tail off to prove myself every single day. And a coordinator quit during that time frame, and I got hired as a full-time employee at that point. So I got in because I knew people, but I stayed because I worked my tail off. Right.
You know, and Ray, I'm going to let you ask, obviously, your next question, but this is a really important point. And I'm going to rephrase what you just said, which probably was the first time I've ever done it to you, but it's not that you knew people, because I think this is important. It's young people need to understand they're always sort of interviewing. They're always sort of projecting who they are. If you had been someone weird or not a good coach or not good with the young people, Judy Roberts would not have said, hey, you should interview at Anheuser-Busch, right? It was because how you came across without you even trying to do that, right? It was just, I'm doing my job. I'm coaching. And so it turns out a very high, powerful person who happened to be a woman, and Angie Bush says, you should interview. So young people need to remember they're always being observed. So I just want to rephrase
that.
That's
a really good point. Because there was a point where you didn't know Judy Roberts, right? First practice, her daughter walks out onto the field and you're the coach. So you were interviewing more or less when Judy Roberts got to know what kind of coach you were. So fine point, Tony. last question. So we had a gentleman of color on, I think maybe our last show or two, and he talked about the isolation in a company filled with males who are of white males, just say it. Did you feel, and if you did, I'd love to hear what it felt like. Did you feel isolated as a woman? Like, you know, hey, let's go grab a drink. Hey, let's have lunch. Hey, come on, you know. What about that Cardinals game last night? Like, how was the social environment for a woman at a company like Anheuser-Busch 30 years ago?
Yeah, it definitely evolved over time. When I first started, was there some isolation? Maybe a little bit. But again, you have to have a mindset that you belong.
Mm-hmm. And so, that's a great point.
Yeah, and that was something that I worked really hard on. And, you know, I had brothers. I worked, you know, I did soccer camps with guy coaches. I was coached by male coaches. I was, you know, I'd been around a lot of guys in all kinds of different roles. And so I was comfortable. You know, I was comfortable in that environment. And so for me to go have a beer with my male counterparts, that was easy for me. But, you know, other women, maybe not. I don't know. But I was comfortable in that environment. And, you know,
interesting.
But I did have to, I will say, when I said that point about you got to have the mindset that you belong, I will say it was intimidating to walk into rooms, in conference rooms, and, you know, have there be, you know, eight seats at the table and 10 around the backside, you know, and you got to walk in. If you were invited to the meeting, you got to walk in. And if there's an empty seat at the table, you got to take it, right? You got to sit down at that table. Because if you sit in the back, you've now positioned yourself as potentially second class, right?
Mm-hmm.
So all these little intricacies that you guys probably never thought about. You probably never walked into a conference room and thought, should I sit at the table or should I sit in the chairs around the outside? You walked in and there was an empty seat at the table. You sat down.
Well, Tony and I have talked about this with a young person going into graduate school and the vertical business of us all climbing the corporate ladder, and that today's generations are much more thinking about life balance and work life and each other and what they've been through in so many different ways. If there was a seat at the table, you know, in the day of climbing the ladder, you just took the damn seat. Like, oh, cool, seat at the table. Like, you never thought twice about not taking it. That was the competitive climb the ladder thing. I want to be seen. I want to be sitting around the table with the big boys or whatever. So you're totally right about that. And I see how different that might be as you would walk into a room, you know, the only woman in the room.
So a lot of things I had to be intentional about that were just sort of came natural. For you guys.
Yeah.
I had to think about things and be intentional about things to make sure I was seen as credible.
Part 2 of this podcast will be available next week. For more information, please visit us at www.thewisdomcircle.com. Thank you.